PTA. What they're looking for is the barber and the bellhop and the numbers runner and the taxi driver.
They were looking for the folks in the neighborhood who knew, you know, where the parties were, who knew where the fun stuff was happening, who knew everybody, basically. The tobacco companies referred to them as kingfish. Today, we just call those people influencers.
You can actually look at these internal corporate documents to see how influencing worked. We can find this online today, right? There are industry-sponsored influencers that are followed by others. In some ways, the industry invented these practices. And our strategy, this memo says, is to hand out what they call boast material. That is like free samples. But they say you have to do it in a secretive way. It can't look like you are manipulating others. There's a black psychologist who actually advised the industry about this strategy. He emphasized the importance of creating images that depict people, quote, in the way black people see themselves, erasing any hint of what the white man thinks of us, and carefully editing these images so that the nature of its appeal has been divested of any exploitation or manipulative connotations.
And remember those billboards that Keith said dotted his neighborhood? The same ones that sent Mandrake on his whole crusade? The lawsuit documents show that there was a method to the marketing there, too.
I have documents that show that they knew exactly how many people walked by any given billboard at any given time, and whether those billboards were visible from the apartments that I lived in. They know that if black people travel on a particular bus from their neighborhood into downtown Pittsburgh, let's say, then you can advertise black-themed mentholated ads on the inside of the bus, and you know you're reaching your audience. However, if those buses go through white neighborhoods, you can't advertise black-themed ads on the outside of the bus because you're trying to keep white menthol smokers who might be turned off by black-themed ads. The specificity of their understanding of things like segregation, transportation patterns, who lives where, who works where, and how you reach people was really one of the most stunning things in researching this book.
And black political figures and black institutions, they were implicated in all this too. I remember when I was growing up reading my Aunt Carol's Ebony and Jet magazines. She kept them stacked on her coffee table. And it felt like every single issue had an ad for Cool or Newports or Virginia Slims on the back cover. And it turns out that was not an accident. Keith says those ads were designed to make black people feel like they were important.
And, you know, John Johnson, who was a publisher at Ebony, you know, really saw Ebony as like catering to African-American consumers. And his view was that black people wanted and needed what he called compensatory gratification. They were not allowed into country clubs or, you know, there were lots of things that were valued in consumer society. And so the strategy of you might say, clothing a product in black accomplishment, in black upward mobility, in black striving, was a strategy that informed all the advertising in Ebony magazine. And the industry was just, you know, part and parcel of that. Now, the problem with that is that, you know, it's fine if it's about, you know, cars or it's about appliances. But at the same time, you had growing concern in the mid-60s about the health effects of cigarettes. And so you have this mismatch where you have the Ebony magazine, black periodicals that are quiet about the health effects, the negative health effects of cigarette, while promoting cigarette ads as a source of revenue and as a source of African-American upward mobility.
Here's one example of what that looked like. Nat King Cole was at one point probably like the most famous black person in America.
You know, paragon of African-American musical accomplishment, beautiful, you know, crooning voice. Unforgettable.
And if you look at old footage of Nat King Cole, he was almost always smoking. Nat King Cole died of lung cancer.
when Ebony magazine covered his death, they never mentioned smoking once. When they covered his death, full biographical sketch on every feature of this man's accomplishments, including civil rights accomplishments, didn't mention cigarettes. In that same issue, four different ads for menthol cigarettes.
And all this marketing and influence seeking, it worked wonders for the tobacco industry. In the early 1960s, only about 5% of black folks who smoked were menthol smokers. But as we know, a few decades later, at least 80% of black smokers are menthol smokers. Jump to when Mandrake was crusading against menthol marketing on the south side of Chicago in the 1990s. One of his foils was the then head of the NAACP, a dude named Benjamin Hooks. Hooks said that claiming black folks would be swayed by ads and billboards was paternalistic and condescending. He said that smoking was a matter of personal choice. And Hooks, as it turned out, was also being paid by the company that made Newports. And it's that history of industry influence, Keith said, that should make us skeptical today of some of the people making arguments against the menthol ban on the grounds of it being a civil rights issue.
Well, I was just being informed this afternoon about a poll that was being done by a Democratic pollster that is making the rounds, that is funded, not surprisingly, by Altria.
Altria is the tobacco company that used to be known as Philip Morris.
Which purports to find that black voters might be upset about, or some black voters might be upset about a menthol ban, and that the Biden administration should think very, very carefully about finalizing what has been proposed by the FDA, which is an outright ban of menthol cigarettes. And you see this with, you know, people who are claiming that the ban on menthol will produce all kinds of, you know, police surveillance and violence against black communities today. They're also taking money from the industry. And these are, like, these are tested arguments, right, that have been shown to resonate, that are produced, if you scratch the surface, they are brought to you by the makers of tobacco products, right? And that's part of the strategy here.
So I asked Keith about Eric Garner. You might remember in 2014, Eric Garner was standing on a sidewalk in Staten Island, New York, when he was confronted by New York City police officers. Those officers sat on his head and his neck, all while he tried to yell, "I can't breathe," over and over. Eric Garner's death was caught on video, and it became another touch point in this long history of black people and policing. What you might not remember is that the stated reason the cops gave for confronting Eric Garner in the first place was that they suspected him of selling Lucy's. Eric Garner's mother, notably, has come out against a ban on menthols. The thinking goes, if menthols become a prohibited product, then the consequences of police enforcement of that ban is going to fall on black folks and black neighborhoods. Keith feels for the people who are moved by those arguments, but he wants to remind people the enforcement of the ban is less likely to fall on individual smokers, despite what cigarette companies may want you to think.
People would like you to think that you're going to produce more people crying out, "I can't breathe," if you ban the menthol cigarette. But they have it upside down. The ultimate endpoint of smoking menthols or any cigarettes is "I can't breathe." Strangling your lungs, causing emphysema, causing lung cancer. The difference between the murder of Eric Garner and the industry is that the industry's, we don't actually have them on video. We don't actually see the long, long process. This is not a story that plays out over minutes. It's not a story that plays out over weeks. It's a story that plays out over decades. And you can't see the people, if I were to be really harsh about it, who have their hands around the neck of black people. It's really the industry that wants you to think that, like, they're on the side of safeguarding the health of black folks, when in fact, they've never been on the side of safeguarding the health of black folks. In fact, the cigarette is probably, as Lewis Sullivan said, the cigarette is the only consumer product which is deadly if used as instructed.
All right, y'all, that is our show. But coming up on Life Kit, how to reset your stress.
Stress resets are quick ways to improve how you feel in minutes, and that allows you to do things that will help you solve problems rather than make things so much worse for yourself.
This episode was produced by Xavier Lopez. It was edited by Leah Donella. Our engineer was James Willett. As for me, I'm Gene Demby.
I'm B.A. Parker.
Be easy, y'all.
Hydrate.
And you are listening to NPR.
Larry is news you can use.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be on your show again as we move inexorably towards spring.
I'm wondering how hot this summer is going to be.
You know, everything has been a month early this year.
Well, I think we got warm in February.
We did. This year was just this year was weird across the board, as we all know.
The Larry Mueller Show, weekday mornings at 11 on WPR News.
Support for WPR comes from the Grand Theater in Wausau, hosting the London Chamber Orchestra Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, with pianist Bruce Liu, on Saturday, March 1st. More at grandtheater.org.
Support comes from the Kenosha Community Foundation, a public charity that encourages community members to build a legacy for themselves and their families through tax-advantaged giving. To learn how, visit kenoshafoundation.org. Or call 262-654-2412.
This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From the Lummelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lummelson.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is NPR's Life Kit. I'm Mary Alcigara.
You ever just get completely overwhelmed? The phone is ringing nonstop. You've got dozens of unread emails just from today. Your kids are fighting over a toy. You open the mail, and you've got a huge unexpected bill from the doctor's office. Oh, and you're hangry, so that doesn't help anything. The stress, you know, sometimes it just reaches a fever pitch. That can feel terrible in our bodies.
For some people, it's very physical.
Jenny Tates is a clinical psychologist, and she says stress also shows up in our thoughts and our behaviors.
So if I'm feeling really angry, that usually includes some sort of judgment of that was really unfair. In my body, I may be feeling really tense and scowling, and my behavior might be to send an aggressive text or say something really rude or yell.
In these moments when we're overextended, it's hard to carve out a path forward. Jenny would like you to try something, though, called a stress reset.
Stress resets are quick ways to improve how you feel in minutes, and that allows you ultimately to do things that will help you solve problems rather than make things so much worse for yourself.
Jenny wrote a book called Stress Resets, How to Soothe Your Body and Mind in Minutes. And on this episode of Life Kit, we're going to give you a whole bunch of resets for your mind, your body, and your behavior. You'll pick what works for you, depending on what your stress feels like and how it's showing up. Jenny, in the book, you outline different types of stress resets for your mind, for your body, and for your behavior. How are these different?
So mind resets specifically target thinking in ways that don't serve us. Body resets really target our physical experience of stress, and behavior resets really are meant to improve our behavior so we don't act in ways that just makes stress skyrocket.
So how would you know that you might need a mind reset?
When you are really, really stuck in overthinking, thinking the worst, and lacking clear perspective, and you're thinking in ways that don't inch you closer to problem solving, but you feel like you're drowning in worst case scenario thoughts.
Okay, so let's walk through a few of the mind resets from the book. I'll tell you a few of my favorites. One was name that emotion. Tell me what that one is.
Naming your emotion, just taking a step back and observing and describing your emotion to notice. I am feeling sad, and then labeling its intensity. Maybe you're feeling sad at a 3 on a 0 to 5 scale. Loosens the grip of sadness, because when you're able to observe your emotion, this allows us to not be engulfed by them, but to see them with distance and openness. And naming them technically kind of disrupts activity in your limbic system, which is the emotional part of the brain, and allows you to engage your prefrontal cortex, which is the more reasonable part of your brain. So even if this sounds very simple, it actually physiologically makes a really profound difference.
Okay, another one I really liked, another mind reset, is sing your thoughts. What is this one about?
So singing your thoughts really gets at the concept of cognitive diffusion, which means playing with your thoughts rather than taking them so seriously. And one of the funnest ways to remember this is if you know that you have a recurrent thought that's simply not true and not helpful, but something that's likely to come up when you're feeling emotions intensely. Let's say you're feeling lonely on a Saturday night and your mind tends to berate you with the thought that I'm a loser. Rather than, you know, telling yourself you're not or trying to convince yourself, really seeing that for what it is, it's just noise. To remember that, if you did something like saying I'm a loser to the tune of do you believe in magic, or one of my clients taught me this, and I think this is like the best way to apply this, is even just thinking what are thoughts, like to the Hathaway song, what is love, love can't hurt me no more, you know, what are thoughts, thoughts can't hurt me no more. So if your thoughts are more like Play-Doh rather than cement, they can't hold you back in your life.
All right, so the other mind reset that I really liked was make a pie chart of your life. Can you explain this one?
Yes. So making a pie chart is really a way to remember all of the things that matter to us. And so if we take a step back and we write down with a pen and paper all of the various domains of our lives that matter, let's say our health, our career, our friendships, our hobbies, and then visually representing them so their relative weight is aligned with how much they matter. So maybe health is like 30% and hobbies is 20%, or, you know, you need to really do some soul searching and come up with the numbers that represent what's truest for you. And making a pie chart of our lives is such a essential way to gain perspective when something disappointing happens, because it's so easy if you're doing something like interviewing for a job you really want to think that everything is terrible if you don't get that role. And of course, it's a huge disappointment. And I don't want to minimize that at all. But I also want people to realize that even if something feels like it's everything, there are a lot of other things that matter.
Mm-hmm. You say it's kind of like zooming out to see the full picture.
Exactly.
Got it. Okay, let's talk about body resets. When would you know that you might need one of these?
If you are feeling really physically stressed, if you're really tense, if your shoulders are up to your ears, if you're finding that you're short of breath, if you feel really distracted by your body, like you can't sit at your desk because you feel so restless or overwhelmed physically.
Okay. All right, so one is move your body in short, quick bursts. What might that look like?
If you're feeling very revved up, a lot of times people just use that as evidence that something's really wrong. And so if you instead do something like do some jumping jacks, and then you can attribute your physical symptoms of stress to the exercise you're doing rather than something that you're catastrophizing and feeling afraid of.
Mm-hmm. Another one is expand your gaze. And I have to say, I tried this the other day when I was feeling really stressed out, and I was out to lunch, but thinking about and overthinking about something. And this really worked. Can you talk about what it means, expand your gaze?
I'm so happy this really worked for you. Yeah, a lot of times as part of our stress response, we hyper-focus or we zoom in on what is we're stressed about. And so simply zooming out to adopt a more relaxed view. So you might notice three sights, maybe you notice three sounds, because when we're stressed, our pupils tend to dilate and we narrow our attention. This is part of our fight or flight response. But when we literally relax our gaze, it's a little easier to just realize that there's so much more than the narrow focus of our stress.
All right, one more body reset. Sigh it out. Now, let's talk about this one, because I do find that this helps, but also if you're around other people and you're deep sighing, it can make them feel a little bit uncomfortable or anxious.
Yeah, and Muriel, this is the reason that there's 75 options in here, because different things really work for different people. But to do this, you gently close your lips and you inhale through your nose, then take another inhale through your nose. So, and then an extended exhale, and this is called a physiological sigh. And repeating it a couple of times is known as cyclic sighing. And researchers have found that people practicing this for 5 minutes a day experience more positive emotions. And when you intentionally sigh, your lungs expand, and so you release more carbon dioxide. And a lot of carbon dioxide is associated with anxiety. And so by practicing this, you can kind of reset your breathing pattern, feel a little bit more relaxed, and then doing this can kind of lend itself to slowing down your breathing in general.
All right, so our last category is behavior resets. How might you know that you need one of these?
When you are acting in ways that are almost like the equivalent of a high-interest credit card, where short-term you might be feeling pretty good, but long-term your behaviors are going to come back to haunt you. So oftentimes stress isn't just a feeling, but also a behavior. And it might be helpful to just take a step back and think about, what are your go-to stress behaviors that you want to improve? Is it being mean to the people around you? Is it canceling plans that you actually would enjoy because you want to curl up in bed? And so the first step would be to get really clear on what you tend to do when you get stressed, and know that there are a lot of ways to make this moment better that aren't going to hurt us long term.
Okay, so some examples from the book are, for instance, to build a hope kit. What would that look like?
Creating a collection of objects, pictures, other sorts of mementos that remind you of things being better can help keep you going. And if you're someone that has a really good friend group, and you could look at a picture of some close friends, or if music has always been a really powerful mood boost for you, having a playlist that you go to. Remarkably, there's an app called the Virtual Hope Box app, and people that struggle with suicidal feelings who use the Virtual Hope Box app actually have a reduction in feelings of wanting to die. And again, reminding ourselves in our hardest moments that we can continue forward and things will get better and have been better is such a gift to ourselves, rather than predicting and rehearsing all of the ways things will continue to be terrible.
Okay, another behavior reset is to do a good deed. What might you do? What are some examples?
There are so many ways to do good deeds. It could be something big, it could be something small, even just noticing someone that might not normally be noticed. Sending someone a card just out of the blue is a really sweet gesture. And if you want to really commit to this, even finding a volunteer opportunity could make a really big difference. And this is such a nice way to feel like you have a say in your life. A lot of the reasons that we feel stressed is because we feel powerless, or we're so focused on all of the things that are going wrong. And doing something nice is a way to actually feel like you have some ability to make things better, and also gives you a little bit of perspective and helps you feel like you can live by your values, even if so much is out of your control.
Yeah. Okay, what about take one step forward? I liked this one a lot.
Taking one step forward is about doing the thing that we can do. And so rather than feeling overwhelmed, really picking one thing that you want to try to do to move closer to your goals. And so rather than making things feel really overwhelming by being too ambitious, just being really clear on the one thing that you can do that will be realistic and within reach. And it was really amazing, Marielle, for this book, I interviewed someone named John Moynihan, who is a police officer who was really seriously injured. He was shot while working, and I asked him how he went from being in critical care to returning to his life in so many ways. And he set one goal at a time, and his first goal, starting when he was in the hospital, was doing this run that he did every summer since childhood. It was a 7-mile run. That was just his goal. It wasn't, how am I going to figure the rest of my life out? How am I going to fully recover? It was like, how do I like learn how to walk again so I could complete this run somehow, even if I'm walking it? And setting that one goal created a positive cycle where other positive forward movement came as a result.
Okay, so these are all really helpful resets that can help us in the moment when we're feeling overwhelmed by stress. I wonder, what's the work after those moments, right? What can we do to kind of improve or change our lives so that maybe we're not experiencing as much stress?
For most of us, mental health is really a series of behaviors, and a lot of us underestimate that our habits can be as powerful as antidepressants. And so rather than waiting to be in a really tough situation and trying to get yourself out of it, there are things we can do in advance. You know, getting a good night's sleep is a huge way to relieve stress. Exercising every day is a really powerful antidepressant. Connecting with people on a regular basis is such a powerful tool that even reduces the risk of getting a cold. And so rather than just leaning on quick things in difficult moments, we also want to set ourselves up to feel like our day-to-day life is more enjoyable and more livable and setting us up for success. And so I don't want anyone to feel like the goal of life is to build a hope kit or to sing your thoughts, but doing those things will allow us to unhook from the things that are holding us back and inch towards the things that we want our lives to stand for.
Wow, I feel like I could talk to you about this for days. Thank you so much. These are really helpful, Jenny.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. I want everyone to really realize that a little can go such a long way. It's like small wheels on a big suitcase. A moment of awareness and a doable strategy can make what feels overwhelming really doable.
All right, time for a recap. If your mind is feeling all squirrely, try a mind reset. Name an emotion. Sing your thoughts. Make a pie chart of what's important in your life. Or maybe you're feeling like you need a body reset. Try moving your body, relaxing your gaze, or doing some cyclic sighing. Or if you've been acting out a little bit, maybe you try a behavior reset. Put together a collection of objects that make you hopeful. Do a good deed. Or just take one step forward towards a goal. Now, these resets aren't everything you need to know about mental health, but they will give you some space to figure out what you need and what changes you'd like to make in your life. This episode of Life Kit was produced by Margaret Serino. Megan Kane is our supervising editor, and Beth Donovan is our executive producer. Engineering support comes from Stacey Abbott. I'm Ariel Segarra. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Life Kit from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals with a track record of excellence. More information on this year's MacArthur Fellows is at macfound.org.
Got questions about changes we've made here on WPR? We set up wpr.org/new so you can find everything you need, including schedules, station maps, and more. Visit wpr.org/new.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Second Century Endowment Fund, a board-designated endowment fund providing ongoing financial support for WPR in its second century of service to the residents of Wisconsin.
Support comes from the law offices of Frank J. Parise, specializing in criminal defense, traffic, and DUIs. 262-656-9906. The law offices of Frank J. Parise since 1985. Located in Kenosha at 7001 30th Avenue. Your gateway to public radio is WGTD, HD1, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wisconsin Public Radio from Gateway Technical College.
Doug Gordon, welcome to Beta. Today, comedian Paul Scheer sits down to discuss his candid memoir, Joyful Recollections of Trauma.
He just reached across the table and started choking me until I was like, no, you don't have to pay, And then kind of like dropped me into my seat.
Also, Mateo Ascarapor on his big departure of a second novel, This Great Hemisphere.
And I opened up a blank Word document and I put world building at the top and I just allowed myself to ask every single question that came to mind.
And biographer James Kaplan tells us how Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and Bill Evans joined forces to create the landmark jazz album, Kind of Blue.
The amazing thing is that every full take on that album, except for one, was a first take.
All this is coming up on Beta in just a moment. First, this news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Russian President Vladimir Putin apologized today to the leader of Azerbaijan after the deadly plane crash of an Azerbaijan airliner in Kazakhstan bound for the Russian Republic of Chechnya this week. The Kremlin said in a statement that air defense systems were responding to Ukrainian drone strike in Chechnya's regional capital. But Putin did not take responsibility for the crash. NPR's Elena Moore reports.
In a Kremlin readout of the call, Putin characterized the crash, which killed 38 people, as a tragic incident, apologizing that it happened in Russian airspace. It comes a day after White House National Security spokesman John Kirby addressed Russia's potential involvement.
We do have seen some early indications that would certainly point to the possibility that this jet was brought down by Russian air defense systems.
Kirby added that an investigation conducted by Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan is ongoing, and the U.S. has offered its assistance. Elena Moore, NPR News.
The Slovakian prime minister says he may stop supplying electricity to Ukraine if Kyiv doesn't reverse a decision to block Russian gas flows. Terry Schultz reports the European Union supports Ukraine's decision to halt the Russian gas delivery.
As of January 1st, Ukraine says it will stop allowing the transit of Russian gas through its territory as long as Moscow continues waging war. Slovakian Prime Minister Robert Fico wants to maintain his country's gas supply from Russia and says if Kyiv goes through with the cutoff, Slovakia may stop providing electricity, which Ukraine desperately needs with Russia destroying its energy infrastructure. Fico asked the European Commission, the EU's executive arm, to get involved, but the Commission declined as it doesn't want EU countries to continue buying fuel supplies from Russia. Slovakia cut off military aid to Ukraine under the leadership of Fico, who visited Russian President Vladimir Putin a week ago and is offering to host peace talks between the two sides. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
New York State Attorney General Letitia James released video yesterday of a man who was fatally beaten in a New York prison this month. 43-year-old Robert Brooks died December 10th. The body camera footage showed correctional officers punching and kicking him while he was handcuffed. James called it shocking and disturbing.
I do not take lightly the release of this video, especially in the middle of the holiday season. But as Attorney General, I release these videos because I have a responsibility and duty to provide the Brooks family, their loved ones, and all New Yorkers with transparency and accountability.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul is calling for the 14 employees involved be fired. This is NPR News. In London, dozens of flights have been canceled and delayed because of thick fog. Weather forecasters say the poor weather conditions could last into tomorrow. The disruption comes on one of the busiest travel weekends of the year, after Christmas and before New Year's Day. Severe weather is disrupting holiday travel in the U.S. FlightAware says more than 3,700 flights have been delayed in the U.S. so far today. NPR's Kristen Wright reports much of Louisiana is under a tornado watch.
Baton Rouge and Shreveport, Louisiana, Mobile and Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and Jackson, Mississippi are among cities under serious threat. National Weather Service meteorologist Frank Pereira says destructive long-range tornadoes could cause major damage in the South.
could be long track tornadoes, meaning they stay on the ground for quite a while, and they could be very strong tornadoes, EF3, which is really significant.
Large hail and damaging winds are also creating adverse conditions as many set out in cars and planes to ring in the new year soon. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
President-elect Donald Trump is asking the Supreme Court to delay a possible ban on TikTok from going into effect. The court is set to hear arguments on January 10th on whether a law is constitutional that would ban the video app if it's not divested from its China-based parent company. Trump's lawyers are asking for more time to allow the incoming Trump administration to pursue a political resolution. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
Previously on Beta.
Every time a player lands on or passes the Go space, the player will collect $200 from the banker.
Two American scientists are lost in the swirling maze of past and future ages.
You know, I haven't gone back to listen to myself again.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta. Today, Matteo Ascarapor returns to the show to discuss the follow-up to his best-selling debut novel, Black Buck. It's called This Great Hemisphere, and it's not a sequel to Black Buck, not even close.
This Great Hemisphere is set 500 years in the future in a world where there are invisible people who are literally see-through, and then members of the dominant population who have visible skin.
Also, journalist James Kaplan on the cats that changed the course of jazz with his book, Three Shades of Blue. Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and Bill Evans.
Coltrane had a way of taking chords and finding parts to chords in jazz that nobody had ever thought of before.
But first, Paul Scheer. Paul is an award-winning comedian, actor, filmmaker, and podcaster. He's probably best known for his role as Andre from the FX comedy The League, as well as supporting roles in 30 Rock, Black Monday, and Veep. Paul's the host of Earwolf's comedy film podcast, How Did This Get Made? On this pod, Paul often entertains his co-hosts and his audience with funny anecdotes about his life. Paul has now collected all those stories in one place. He's written an honest, heartfelt, humorous, and heartbreaking memoir called Joyful Recollections of Trauma.
Trauma is a term that I think is thrown around a lot. I think I can take that term and feel like I did have trauma, but I also didn't live a life devoid of love, happiness, and joy. And I think a lot of the times these things go together. And, you know, when I talk about that idea of like trauma dumping, you know, sometimes people will just focus on one part of their lives. And I thought that would be disingenuous. Like there are highs and lows and there are embarrassing moments. And there are these things that we live through. Like trauma is the fire in which we are forged to a certain degree, right? You know, and I wanted to really respect that, but also it came from when I told these stories, like the story about my grandma telling me not to open the door to the murderous butcher. Like I'm telling it fun. It's not, I'm not like, oh, and then my grandma told me the story. You know, I'm remembering it as fun. It's the looking back that's like, oh, that was a little messed up. You're right. Like, you know, it's like it, the, my relationship to it. And I think this is what I was realizing when I had kids was like, they'll go with anything because they don't know any better. So that like part of it was like, oh, this is my life. My life is like this. This is not, I don't view it as being traumatic because I just view it as what my life is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to do it. You were only 3 years old when your parents divorced and your stepfather, Hunter, did not treat you well. Can you tell us a bit about how he abused you?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. That term abuse is something that I really reconciled with because I'm not one to say like, oh, I was an abused child. It feels like, wow, that I don't know. There's an issue with that term in my mind. Mm-hmm. Am I worthy of that? People have had it worse. But the truth is, yes, I was. All right. And part of writing this book, I think, was kind of owning that on some level. Yes, I was. My stepfather was incredibly abusive, physically, mentally, verbally. And part of my journey was kind of coping with that, dealing with that. How do you balance that? And, you know, he was a person who was not only that. He could be gregarious and joyful in one moment. And then, you know, I talk about this moment when I first realized there was something maybe off about him. We were playing Monopoly, and it was just me and him on an afternoon after school. He landed on one of my properties. He owed me money, and he looked at me like, "Do you really want to do this?" And I'm like, what do you mean? Do it? Yes, of course. It's Monopoly. I want my money. Give me my money. But he looked at me as if I was starting a fight, like even asking for this money. And he kept on pressing, "Think about what you're doing." And I'm like, "I have. Give me my 300 Monopoly dollars," right? And in the middle of that, what I thought was playful, funny, weird, because I've been playing Monopoly with my dad, my mom, everybody else, he just reached across the table and started choking me. Until I was like, no, you don't have to pay. You don't have to pay. And then kind of like dropped me into my seat. And that was very much what every day was like. It was like, I dropped my seat. He picked up the dice, rolled it again, and we were off playing, keep on playing the game. Right. So you start to think about, like, when you think about abuse, I think it's often like housed in this thing. People are cowering in a corner or there's something going on. It wasn't just like a bad weekend, a bad week. It was just a part of everyday life. We finished that game of Monopoly. And you walk away going, was I just choked in the middle of that game of Monopoly? Like, but it's so not focused on that, it's hard to reconcile. What is that? What just happened there? But I was a, you know, kid in fourth grade who was choked out because I wanted money for Baltic Avenue, you know? and I think that that's hard to convey to people how every day it can be. That type of abuse, and again, verbal, physical, mental, you just had to be kind of prepared for at all times. You know, am I going to be locked in a closet? Am I going to be, you know, left out in the street? Am I going to be, you know, made fun of because, you know, he always thought my ears were too big, you know, thought that, you know, like all these things that, you know, you realize there are parts of your body, or there's parts of your person, I should say. Like how you view yourself, it is through the eyes of this adult who's telling you, oh, you're ugly, you're not worthy of this, or I'm going to put you in here. It's like, you know, your self-worth starts to really crater in many different ways.
And to make matters worse, Hunter's violence was contagious. You looked for fights and became a bully. How were you able to move on from this behavior?
Well, I think, you know, part of living in an abusive household is surviving. And I had definitely systems that were like locked in for me, you know, whether it's like creating these fantasies where, you know, it's like I am acting out like shows in my mind where I'm like this grizzled police detective, you know, I'm like, I'm trying to create spaces for myself, you know, whether it's like finding my own little like kid cave, like the beginning of a man cave. but part of it as I got older was fighting back. I realized, I think there was a really powerful moment in my life when I realized, oh yeah, he can hit me, but I can also hit back. I don't have to take these hits. Now, that opens up a Pandora's box, because if I start hitting back, then the hits that come back at me are going to be a lot stronger. So in my way of defending myself and trying to stave off attacks, I kind of opened a part of myself that was ready to throw down, to fight, to be ready at a moment's notice. And, you know, I'm ashamed to say it, but like everybody who came at me in any sort of an aggressive way was treated like Cordell. So, you know, as a 12-year-old kid who's fighting a 40-something-year-old man, I don't think any 12-year-old kid that I'm fighting was used to that kind of force and violence either. But I didn't know how to moderate that. Oh, I'm going to fight differently with somebody my age. I was going to fight as hard as I was fighting with him. And I think it took me a long time to understand why I had this kind of hair trigger. And, you know, I just thought, oh no, I'm just defending myself. No, but I was actually it gave me something. It gave me like a power over. It was like, you know, when you're in those, again, I say I have a hard time with that term abuse, but abuse often means that you're powerless. And